The views and opinions expressed here are those of the guests, and are not the official position of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
One of the most remarkable aspects of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is its unique history. Throughout the world, great stories from faithful church members have only added to that history. This program shares some of these incredible stories of faith, perseverance, hope, and inspiration. You're listening to Legacy. I'm your host, Nathan Wright. A small stone chapel in the rural countryside of England stands today as a monument to the restored gospel of Jesus Christ. Through the missionary efforts of Wilford Woodruff, Brigham Young, Willard Richards, and others, 1,500 people joined the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints in the small towns and villages around the Gadfield Elm Chapel. In studio, joining us today is Emily Utt. Emily has worked for the Church History Department for 4 years. Most of her time is spent researching and writing for church-owned historic site exhibits. These sites help missionaries and visitors find stronger connections with our sacred past. She has degrees in religion and history from Case Western Reserve University and is currently enrolled at Goucher College studying historic preservation. Emily, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
Tell us, what is the Gadfield Elm Chapel?
I had the same question when I started researching, when I was given this project a few years ago. I had never heard of the Gadfield Elm Chapel, and I hadn't really heard much about the mission of the 12 to England. But as I studied it and was given more information, it's become one of my favorite church history stories. And for me, it's become a great example of what a member referral can do for the church. So let me just explain what I mean by that. There was a group of people living in rural England, farmers and day laborers and shoemakers, just very common everyday people who were searching for truth, who were seeking to know more about Jesus Christ, and had formed a small church, about 600 people. And they met together every week. They had preaching meetings. They had just fellowship meetings. And after about 6 years, they realized they needed more. And fortunately, at about that same time, the missionaries for the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints showed up. And within a few months, about 1,500 people had joined the church. So it was a fantastic conversion effort for these people. Now, how the missionaries got there is a very interesting story as well. The missionaries were actually apostles from the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints that had been sent to England in 1840 by Joseph Smith to enlarge the church. The church was struggling. There was a lot of apostasy going on in Missouri and in Nauvoo, and the church needed strength. And instead of turning inward, the church turned outward and sent missionaries to England. One of these, Wilford Woodruff, went to an area called the Staffordshire Potteries. It's a couple hours north of the area of the Gadfield Elm Chapel, and started preaching. And shortly after he arrived there, he met a man named William Bembo, who had just joined the church and was all fired up with the news of the restoration. And Wilford Woodruff and William Bembo spent hours late at night talking about the gospel. And in one of those conversations, William told Wilford about his brother John, who lived a couple hours south in Herefordshire. And then one morning, Wilford Woodruff got up to preach, actually on his birthday. And the Spirit told him while he was in that preaching meeting that he needed to go south and start preaching to the people there. And so after the meeting, he had another visit with William Bembo, and William agreed to accompany him south. And William showed him where his brother lived. They arrived. And 2 days after Wilford Woodruff arrived in the south of England, he baptized John Bembo, his wife Jane, and 4 of their friends. And that opened the door to other people. John Bembo was the leader of this little group of people called the United Brethren that I was talking about a little earlier. And so John was able to introduce Wilford Woodruff to all of his neighbors and all of his friends and started this member conversion process, this member referral process. John Bembo introduced him to his neighbor. His neighbor was baptized. Then his neighbor introduced him to his neighbor, and it went on and on and on. One of the other most influential baptisms was a man named Thomas Keenton, who was superintendent of this group of people, the United Brethren. And John Bembo introduced Wilford Woodruff to Thomas Keenton. Thomas Keenton, of course, was a little reluctant to join the church. He was superintendent of his own religious group. And Wilford Woodruff told him to go home and pray about it. And he said, if you get an answer that you should join, you will join the church. And Thomas Keenton reluctantly agreed, went home and prayed, and came back and told Wilford Woodruff he would be baptized. And Wilford Woodruff recorded in his journal the day that Thomas Keenton was baptized that, glory, hallelujah, the work of God rolls on. So Wilford Woodruff knew that this Thomas Keenton would be very influential.
I think those of us who have heard of this story of the 1,500 people baptized by Wilford Woodruff and others, think of it as a huge group en masse, you know, coming together and saying, we believe, and everybody's baptized at the same time. But your reference to current member missionary work and the principle of line upon line is really what took place here.
Yep, it took months. Wilford Woodruff arrived in March, and those 1,500 baptisms took place in the space of about a year. So, I mean, every day Wilford Woodruff was baptizing 10 or 15 people, but he still had to convert and preach one by one. There are stories of individual people. There was a man named William Williams, for example, who was a member of this United Brethren group, who had been hearing rumors about the Mormons for months and didn't want to hear what they had to say because all of his friends were being baptized, and he fought against it. And then reluctantly, one day, he went to a meeting just to hear what they were saying, so maybe give him a little more ammunition to fight the Mormons. And he went to that meeting and was converted. And within 2 days, he was baptizing his other friends. I mean, it's an individual process. It's a wonderful story.
Why don't you give us a little background on the United Brethren, how they came to be, what they believed, and what prepared them for this happening?
The United Brethren were Primitive Methodists. It was a breakoff of the Methodist Church. There's a lot of breakoffs in England about the same time. And this group of Primitive Methodists in about 1832 were dissatisfied with the preachings of Primitive Methodism. They felt it'd become too formal and that they had lost their place in the church. And so, led by Thomas Keenton, they broke off. And between 1832 and 1840, about 600 people joined the church. It was a very small group of people, about 600 people, like I just said. And they were all just lay members of the church. There were no paid ministers. The people were assigned a preaching location. So if you showed up at your home on Sunday morning at 10 o'clock, you knew a preacher would be there. And those preachers would rotate through different homes every week. There were about 52 preachers in the United Brethren group.
When you say the church in this context, you're referring
to
the United
Brethren
Church.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so there's a circuit of lay ministers going from home to home, preaching in this
home.
Congregation of 600 people.
And they were all preaching in homes. There was only one chapel that was owned by the group. That was the Gadfield Elm Chapel, which they built in 1836.
Specifically for the United Brethren Church.
Exactly. And an interesting thing that has actually helped us as researchers is that in British law at the time, every non-Church of England religious meeting place had to be registered before it could be used as a preaching place. And the United Brethren registered their 52 meeting places with the local diocese of the Church of England. And so when Mormon missionaries came into town and started preaching, they had immediate access to 52 preaching locations in different towns. And so it immediately spread up the missionary efforts for the church, because they already had set preaching places. They even had set preaching times. Mormon missionaries were able to take those meeting schedules, and instead of a United Brethren preacher showing up at your home at 10 o'clock, it would be a Mormon preacher showing up at 10 o'clock on Sunday morning. It made it a lot easier for us to preach.
So the missionaries came, but there was one event through Wilford Woodruff that actually got the missionaries to this area. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us about Wilford Woodruff and his vision, basically?
Yes, actually, I'll read it. Let me find it in
Thank
here
you.
And I'll read it to you. So Wilford Woodruff was preaching in a town called Hanley. And on his birthday, he stood up to preach after having many discussions with William Benbow. And this is what he said. "It being Sunday, I preached twice through the day to a large assembly in the city hall in the town of Hanley, and administered the sacrament unto the saints. In the evening, I again met with a large assembly of the saints and strangers. And while singing the first hymn, the Spirit of the Lord rested upon me. And the voice of God said to me, 'This is the last meeting that you will hold with this people for many days.'" Wilford Woodruff was very astonished at this because he was having great success in Hanley. He'd baptized about 30 people, had meetings every day, appointments every day. People were waiting to talk to him. When I arose to spoke to the people, I told them that it was the last meeting I should hold with them for many days. They were as much astonished as I was. At the close of the meeting, four persons came forward for baptism. We went down to the water and I baptized them. In the morning, I went in secret before the Lord and asked him what his will was concerning me. The answer I got was that I should go to the south, for the Lord had a great work for me to perform there, as many souls were waiting for the word of the Lord.
So it seems, you know, in that context, success with 30 people would have been quite good for a missionary. And so he must have thought, well, you know, maybe 60, 100 people.
For most missionaries today, 30 people getting baptized in the space of a few months would be a phenomenal missionary success. And this type of baptism record that he would have in Herefordshire was unprecedented. Most people were not joining the church in those kinds of numbers. And so he had no way to expect that he would arrive there and suddenly be overwhelmed with the number of baptisms, finding him and wanting to be baptized.
So once this overwhelming success started, what did he do?
He was still a little overwhelmed. Yeah, within a month, he had baptized 110 people in this area. But the problem was that he was the only person who had authority to baptize and to confirm members of the church. And he saw that this immense growth was going to continue. And so he wrote a letter to his friend Willard Richards, who was an apostle, who was preaching in another part of England, begging him to come and to help him baptize. There just wasn't enough priesthood in the area to make it happen. So in this letter to Willard Richards, which is great, let me just read a little bit of that to you. He says, "I want you to come immediately and be a co-worker with me in the vineyard here. I cannot do the work alone. I am called to baptize 4 or 5 times a day. I want no better man than yourself to commit and labor with me here and help me keep this mighty harvest. If you have nothing on but rags, come. I want your person. Come, and God shall bless you with health and strength." So it took some time for Willard Richards to arrive. He didn't arrive in the area until April 29th, about 6 weeks after Wilford Woodruff arrived. But Willard Richards arrived, and he started preaching and baptizing, and he baptized about 100 people himself in the next couple of months. And then Brigham Young came at about the same time and again baptized a couple hundred people by himself in the next couple of months. It was just everyone who became a missionary was baptizing in that area.
What beliefs did this group of United Brethren have that actually prepared them for the restored gospel? What were some of their practices that Wilford Woodruff and others found as they came upon this group of people?
They believed in the power of prayer. They believed that God was speaking to them and that God had a church prepared for them, a church with authority. There was a convert named William Williams who he said his prayer every day before his baptism was that the Lord would lead him in the right way. He didn't know what that right way was, but he was searching for it. I think the biggest theme that this group had was a group of people that were seeking to do God's will, whatever that was. We don't really know much about their religious practice because they don't really have many records that have survived, but we do know that they were seeking. There was another example of a preacher who they'd never really had set sermons, so they just were supposed to go out and preach. And as they were walking to a meeting, one friend turned to another and said, "What are you going to preach today?" And the friend responded, "I don't know. I have said everything that I can say," and then said, "I hope the Lord will send us light." And shortly after that is when Wilford Woodruff came. Wilford Woodruff said of this group that this body of United Brethren were searching for light and truth, but had gone as far as they could, and were continually calling upon the Lord to open the way before them and send them light and knowledge that they might know the true way to be saved.
As a group, can you describe what kind of people they were?
The United Brethren were common, everyday people. They had women preachers in their group, which is an interesting thing that was happening in Primitive Methodism that I imagine was difficult for some people when they joined the church. Let me find a page that describes. The majority of United Brethren converts, as well as other converts, not all converts from this area were United Brethren, but they were all neighbors and friends. And the majority of them were laborers and farmers. They were shoemakers, butchers, basket makers, carpenters, bricklayers. Almost one-third of the United Brethren converts to the church were young people between the ages of 20 and 30, and almost another third were between the ages of 30 and 40. And most of them were single people or recently married couples. About 60% of these converts were women as well. So it's a very interesting group of people in general that didn't really fit the mold of other converts to the church.
Once they became members, this group wanted to help out a lot, evidently, and actually helped fund some necessary things that happened in England. What
they did,
what was that?
Especially John Benbow was the wealthiest convert from this area, and Thomas Keynton had some money. So between those two and a few other people, they donated £1,000 to the church, which was quite a considerable sum of money. And with that £1,000, Brigham Young and the other apostles printed a new edition of the Book of Mormon, because the British saints craved the Book of Mormon. They only had a few copies available to them that the apostles had brought from the United States, and they wanted to read the Book of Mormon. And they printed, I think, 5,000. Yes. They printed 5,000 copies of the Book of Mormon while in England. And that £1,000 also paid for the production of a church hymnal. Many of these people could not read, but they could sing. And it's easier to memorize words of hymns than it is to memorize scriptures. And so they wanted hymns that match the doctrine of their new church. And so their £1,000 helped pay for a new hymnal that Parley P. Pratt put together. Parley P. Pratt actually wrote about 50 hymns for this hymnal while he was in England. So there's a great legacy of Mormon hymn writing that came out of this mission as well. That £1,000 also helped pay for the printing of the Millennial Star, which was the church's periodical in the British Isles that ran until the 1970s. It was started off as a way for missionaries to communicate doctrine to members of the church. So they printed extracts from the Book of Mormon and letters from Joseph Smith and letters from other missionaries. And that was a major publishing effort that continued on for well over 100 years. Thomas Keynton and John Benbow, as well as others, also gave some of their own personal money to help people that wanted to immigrate to the U.S. but could not afford to on their own. There's some records that say John Benbow personally paid for 40 people to travel to the United States and gather with the saints in Nauvoo, which would have been some personal sacrifice on his own part.
This idea of printing a specific hymnal seems interesting. There had to have been other hymnals that they used beforehand. Why such an importance on this new hymnal?
There were other hymnals, but they were for other churches. And Latter-day Saints had a belief in Joseph Smith as a prophet, and they had a belief in the gathering of Israel and in the Book of Mormon, and they wanted their music to reflect their beliefs. And a lot of these other Protestant hymnals didn't have the same doctrine in them the Latter-day Saint hymnals did. So it was really a continuation of Emma Smith's efforts to print a hymnal in Kirtland. And this hymnal used a lot of the same of Emma Smith's hymns. There's about 70 hymns from Emma's hymnal that ended up in this, what we call the Manchester hymnal, that was printed in England.
Were there any hymns that we would recognize that
there
they used?
There's about 45 hymns from the Manchester hymnal that is still in the hymnal we use today, and about 25 from Emma's hymnal that are in our hymnal today. Just a few that we know. Adam on Diamon was in that hymnal. How Firm a Foundation. I Know That My Redeemer Lives. Now Let Us Rejoice. Guide Us, O Thou Great Jehovah, and the Spirit of God were all in this hymnal, as well as a hymn that was not in Emma's hymnal but became very popular in the modern hymnal as A Poor Wayfaring Man of Grief. And that was in the Manchester hymnal printed by Parley P. Pratt and Brigham Young.
It gives us a little more ownership of mm-hmm. this group of people, knowing they sing the same hymns we do today. So these people converted. Many of them started leaving. What became of the Gadfield Elm Chapel?
Most members of the church that immigrated did so in about 1840 and 1841. And if you have 1,500 members and half of them have moved to the United States and the other half have left the church by then, you don't need a chapel anymore. And so we think, we're not exactly positive, that the chapel was sold in about 1842, perhaps to help offset the costs of people moving to the United States. And then as a church, we forgot about it. It fell into disrepair. It became a barn. There was a family that squatted at the chapel for about 20 years, and it started falling apart. and we even forgot where it was. Wilford Woodruff and others didn't leave any descriptions of the chapel. They said, "We preached at the Gadfield Elm Chapel," and that's all they ever said about it. And so it took some time for members of the church in England to remember where it was, and eventually some members did. And in 1994, the chapel came up for auction, and a group of local church members who had come to love the chapel because of the story it told about the church in their country bought it and took it apart stone by stone because it was falling over. You could touch a wall and the entire wall would move. And they took it apart and rebuilt it and reopened it for tours. And in 2000, Elder Jeffrey R. Holland of the Quorum of the Twelve, whose ancestors were United Brethren converts, went to England and dedicated the chapel as a place for members of the church or anyone interested to come and learn more about this missionary effort and these amazing converts. But the church did not own the chapel. This was a locally funded, a locally run enterprise. And in 2004, President Gordon B. Hinckley was in England, and he has a great love for the British saints and the British church and the British story. And he was given the Gadfield Elm Chapel as a church historic site. And so since 2004, the church has owned it again for the first time in 160 years. And the church has now reopened it as a church site. And missionaries are now stationed at the chapel. And there are exhibits there that so visitors, when they come to the chapel, can learn a little bit more about this missionary effort and about the converts and just experience for themselves what it would have meant to have been a member of the church in this area. It changes you when you visit a church historic site. I can sit at my desk and read the stories and read their journals, but until you get in the countryside and walk the streets that Wilford Woodruff walked and stand in the places that they preached, you don't really understand what these people's lives were about. The chapel is still very rural. The first time I went there, I got lost trying to find it. It's down a dirt road off the beaten path. And it's still farm country. There was a tractor plowing a field as I was in the chapel for the first time. And so it still is a feel of what it was like for Wilford Woodruff to be in that area. And it's a lovely, quiet little spot to visit.
Will you describe where the Gadfield Elm Chapel is in case someone actually is in England and wants to visit this
Absolutely.
Place?
Absolutely. The Gadfield Elm Chapel can be a little difficult to find without a map. The Gadfield Elm area is on the border of three different counties, Herefordshire, Worcestershire, and Gloucestershire, which is, that area is about 100 miles northwest of London and about 30 miles from the border with Wales. It's a very rural area. The Gadfield Elm Chapel is about 15 miles south of the village of Ledbury. So if you can find Ledbury on a map, you should be able to find Gadfield Elm. The farm where John Benbow lived, called Hill Farm, has a historic marker at the pond where about 40 people were baptized. And that pond is about 15 miles north of the village of Ledbury. So if you can find Ledbury in Herefordshire, you should be able to find the Gadfield Elm Chapel.
And try to tell me you didn't practice all those names.
I had to practice those names a lot. The people good. In England get a little upset if you mispronounce the names of their counties.
Very good. There is a very large, almost panoramic painting by Al Rounds on the main floor of the church office building. Could you describe that painting and what it represents to this story?
Yes, I think you're describing a painting of the Herefordshire Beacon. Is that the one? Yes. The Herefordshire Beacon is one of the local landmarks in this part of England. It started off as a Roman fort, and it has all kinds of great battlements on it. And local residents will hike to the top of the Herefordshire Beacon and the other hills in this area just to be in nature. Wilford Woodruff, Willard Richards, and Brigham Young, when in England, visited Herefordshire Beacon several times as a kind of a place to get away from the busyness of their missionary efforts. They were busy all the time baptizing, and there were moments when they needed to step back a little bit. So they one day, I think it was in April of 1840, they climbed the Herefordshire Beacon as a group to discuss the missionary efforts that were going on, to figure out what they needed to do. And it was at that meeting on top of Herefordshire Beacon where they decided to print the Book of Mormon and to print the hymnal and to start printing the Millennial Star. So it has church significance that most residents in the area aren't aware of. And so now a man named Al Rounds has done a painting of that event that shows the entire landscape of this rural countryside with three apostles standing on top of this hill praying about the needs of the members in this area.
It's a beautiful painting.
It is a beautiful painting.
If you would give us a brief description of Church Historic Sites programs, the three types of historic sites that exist, and what the church does with each type.
All right. The church has a very special interest in our history, that our history is tied so much to who we are as a people that we feel it's very important to keep those sacred places alive. So the church manages many different types of sites. We manage what we call restored structures. So that would be a place like Joseph Smith's home in Manchester, New York, where he was living when he was when he received the gold plates and started translating the Book of Mormon, or a place like the Sacred Grove, where we need the exact building to tell the story. And so the church owns those kinds of sites all over the country. The Gadfield Elm Chapel is an example of one of those sites. We also own church historic landmarks, so structures that are architecturally significant or doctrinally significant. So places like the Salt Lake Temple and the Salt Lake Tabernacle are managed by the church in a way to help maintain their historic integrity but still keep them in use. The other type of building we own and help manage are visitor centers, because there are some places that we don't have the building anymore, but the story is still important. So people who visit the Mormon Trail Center in Winter Quarters, Nebraska, can get a sense of our pioneer past, even though there is no actual structure there. So we have exhibits, and missionaries are there to help explain that story. What was the other part of your question?
And also I think monuments is part
yes,
of that.
Yes. Also, the church owns a lot of historic markers and historic monuments. So, for example, the Joseph Smith birthplace site in Sharon, Vermont, there is no structure, there's no building there, but in the early 20th century, Joseph F. Smith went and put up a marker commemorating Joseph Smith's birth. And now you can visit that marker that stands 39 and a half feet tall, commemorating the life of the prophet Joseph Smith. And it's a wonderful reminder of who Joseph was. And we have sites like that all over the church. And that part of our program is still growing a lot. As we become a more international church, we have more sites that we need to mark and take care of.
With replicas built, mm-hmm. Such as in Vermont and in Palmyra, etc. Okay, thank you. So you probably mentioned that Gadfield Elm is the first historic site outside of the U.S., and it seems rather odd to me that it took so long for the church to actually get it.
It did. The church moves very slowly on acquiring historic sites. Unfortunately, we probably could be faster at that, because we do know of these sites that are very important to the church. The Gadfield Elm Chapel is, I think we acquired it first because it has a connection to the 19th century church. It was an ambitious project for us to take it on, because we work with the United States history. Most people in our department aren't well versed in international church issues. And so the Gadfield Elm Chapel was a good chance for us to expand our vision. And we're hopeful that what has happened at the Gadfield Elm Chapel may be replicated in other countries. We may be able to take the things we've learned working in the international church and enlarge that to help tell other international stories. There are hundreds of stories probably similar to this in other countries that we just don't know about and that we would love to know about. And we need members of the church to be championing those causes. The Gadfield Elm Chapel came to us because local members of the church loved this story and told it so often, church leadership in Utah had to pay attention to it. And there's probably stories like that in other places that we need to be paying attention to, but we just don't know about them yet. But we want to.
With such a significant number of people mm-hmm. coming through this Gadfield Elm story, mm-hmm. surely there are church leaders, great apostles, other people that came through this group of people. But you have something else to say
yes.
about that.
You would expect out of this many converts there would be a lot of famous church names. But what I love about this conversion story is that there are no famous church names. Unless you are a descendant of these people, odds are you've never heard any of their names. These were the common everyday members of the church. And what they brought to the church was strength and commitment and faith. They didn't bring leadership and they didn't bring money, but they came with the desire to serve and to build the kingdom. And that is their significant story. They came to Nauvoo and established farms and just went to work. And then they came to Utah and were sent out, and they settled northern Utah and southern Utah, and they were eventually sent to Mexico. And they just went wherever church leadership wanted them to go and never made a big name for themselves, but remained strong and faithful throughout their lives.
You have said that in some of your previous presentations that you don't know all the people, mm-hmm. all these original 1,500 mm-hmm. people, and have a desire to know a few
yes.
more.
Yes, we have. We know that there were between 1,000 and 1,500 converts to this area. We've done extensive research trying to find out who they were. Unfortunately, most missionaries didn't keep good journals in the 1840s, and there was no official church membership system. Now, when a person is baptized, you have forms to fill out, and they're sent to church headquarters, and we keep track of them. In the 1840s, that didn't exist. So the only people we have are Wilford Woodruff, who kept track of about 350 baptisms in his own journal, the people he had baptized, and then about 350 other names. So out of the 1,500 converts, I have names for about 700 people, which means I need the names of 700 other people. And that there are members of the church today whose ancestors are United Brethren. And there are people living in England whose ancestors were United Brethren. And we don't know who they are. And we would love to know who they are so we can include their story in the story of this site.
So you specifically would like to hear from people if their ancestors came from this United Brethren group.
Absolutely.
We don't normally do this, but I'll bet if you gave your email address out and if there was someone who was associated with that, they would love to talk to you.
Absolutely. If you have an ancestor that was United Brethren or that joined the church in England in 1840 or 1841, please contact me. I would love to hear from you. My email address is utte, that's spelled U-T-T-E, at ldschurch.org.
So, in conclusion, tell us why this means so much to church members, or why it should mean so much.
I think this story should mean something to church members because these people that were baptized are just like them. These are regular members of the church that were seeking to do the right thing, and that when they found the truth, they followed it. And I think it's a great example for us today that we should be seeking for truth in our own lives, and that when we find that truth, we should be willing to follow it no matter what that means, and that we shouldn't be looking to become an apostle or a stake president, that if we seek to do the Lord's will, that he will open the way for us. And it's also, for me, a great example of the impact that a powerful missionary can have, that if a missionary follows the Spirit and also seeks to do the Lord's will, he or she can accomplish things that they wouldn't normally think they could do. Wilford Woodruff didn't expect to baptize 1,000 people, but because he was following the Spirit and doing his best as a missionary, the Lord opened the way for him to accomplish a great thing. And I think that's a great lesson for us today to follow.
Thank you. We've been visiting with Emily Utt, employee of the Church History Department, researcher and writer for Church-Owned Historic Site Exhibits. Thank you very much, Emily, for being with us.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Legacy. I'm Nathan Wright.